call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. It's February 12th, 1992, 3:37 p.m. Present at the moment are Senators Pierce, Halford, and Kraft. Senator Collins is on her way. We have first today, first hearing, actually an overview on Senate Bill 376, which is the Omnibus Insurance Reform Bill. Dave Walsh is here to give us a moment-by-moment account of all 149 pages, after which we'll ask incisive questions, I'm sure. As I announced on the floor today, we'd like any comments, concerns from anywhere out there into our office, if possible, by the 21st. We'll bring this bill back before us for public testimony on the 26th of this month. We do have Jay Frank signed up to testify about the bill today, and we will go ahead and allow that, and I'm sure we'll have more concerns on the 26th. Senator Collins has joined us. We are not on teleconference today. You have your red binders, and Mr. Walsh, it's all yours. Oh, by the way, I might tell you that this bill has now been deemed a governor's priority. I don't know whether that helps it. Well, I don't know. I'm just warning you.
I think
you
just
warned me. Yeah. Don't know what that means.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Walsh. I'm the Director of Insurance. And with me are Stan Garlington, Gloria Glover, Ken Sykes, and Don Koch from the division as well. Also, Mr. Frank, who's going to testify here, has worked very hard on the Citizens Task Force that we put together to help with this this bill before you. I have only one piece of disagreement, I guess. Staff told me that in a memo to the chair, they said this bill weighed 7.5 pounds. Our reading is closer to 8, but we consider that to be a minor difference, all considered. The huge ring binders that you have in front of you are the bill plus a side-by-side analysis of each section, old law, new law, and plus comments. Then a sectional analysis, a place for the fiscal note, which has been submitted, but I don't know whether it's made it down here from the third floor, has the zero fiscal note. And then a list of the names and addresses of the people who served on the task force that dealt with the licensing portion of this bill. And then finally, a list of formal meetings, and as you can see, there are a half a dozen or so. That is deceptive in that I think that it's fair to say that there are thousands of hours that have gone into this bill over the last year to get it ready. The bill does a couple of things. First of all, it contains the last model laws necessary for the division to become nationally accredited by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And I know that I've spoken with the committee before as to why that is important, but I think that a review of that is useful. For a small state, national accreditation means that we can rely on the other accredited states for their financial exams of their domestics. That cuts down the cost of our operation. It increases the consumer confidence that Alaskan consumers can have. The second thing that it does is that for Alaskan companies, it allows them to write in other states much more like a domestic in that other state. For example, and not to pick on them, but the largest domestic we have is Alaska National. They write in Washington, and I believe that maybe another state as well. With Alaska being an accredited state, Washington will take our financial examination of Alaska National as being sufficient. If we are not accredited, they will not. And Alaska National will have two choices. They will either have to pay for an exam by the Alaska Division, as required by law, and then pay for an exam by Washington at significant expense to them, or they will re-domesticate in Washington. And, of course, neither option is very good from the company's point of view, and the second option is particularly bad from the point of view of the Alaska insurance market, because our goal is to get more insurance facilities here, not less. And national accreditation is key for that effort. The second major part of the bill is some licensing reform. The system that we currently have has two basic forms of licenses, one for agents and one for brokers. We have approximately 3,600 agents' licenses. They all come due every year on the 1st of July. We have approximately 1,800 brokers' licenses. They all come due on the 1st of January. So our work flow is extraordinarily uneven. For the industry, that's, a pain, I guess, is probably the only word that comes to mind, because our turnaround time on licenses is not what it should be, particularly considering the fact that we have one of the lowest number of licensees in the country. Now, we've reduced our turnaround time from about 8 weeks to 3 weeks through internal measures, but we simply can't get any faster with the system that we have. Similarly, it's just it is just nonsensical to have a license that is renewed every year. What occupational licensing has done, and Director Boudreau is here, and what other states have done, is what we propose to do, and that is to go to a multi-state license with a staggered renewal, and also to go to a single insurance producer's license. What that means is we will have 4,000 licensees. 2,000 would be renewed every year, and the arithmetic works out, you know, assuming a normal bell curve distribution, to about 5 a day. And it'd be just like you do your driver's license, it'd be your birthday or your birth month. That means that the turnaround time for the division can be virtually instantaneous. And that is a tremendous advantage to the business community as they attempt to get new agents online to make sure their renewals are there, et cetera. Even some of the larger agencies that have, in a couple of instances, even dozens of agents will tell you that that the renewal system that we have now is very inefficient from their point of view as well, because they basically have to pull one person off for a month or two to get all these licenses ready to go. This would allow it to be a normal administrative clerical function that one person could do on an ongoing basis, and we think it would work well for everyone. In addition, it would somewhat lower the cost, because our cost of administration is going to be lower. That would lower the cost to the licensee. The third major part of the bill is what I hope is the beginning of a 2 or 3 year program to rewrite the insurance statutes. The bulk of this bill, in terms of volume of sections, or number of sections, I should say, are little noodles that have been hanging out, some of them since the 60s. You'll notice in the latter part of the bill, there are pages and pages where it says, please remove reference to 1974 or 1968. What other states have done is they've spent a substantial amount of money. In the case of New York, it was in the millions. In the case of West Virginia, it was almost a million. And in the case of Wisconsin, it was $500,000 to hire consultants to redo the insurance statutes. I don't have that kind of money in my budget and don't intend to ask for it. And so what we did in putting this bill together is we basically cleaned out the closet. We took every bill idea that anyone had suggested. We took all the little inconsistencies that somebody would make a note of and stick in a file, and we put that into a bill. And the massive size of this is really, we felt kind of in a catch-22. We could have introduced this in three parts or even more if we'd split all the models off individually. And we've done that in the past, and the division was subjected to, I think, some legitimate criticism that when you have 5 or 6 or 7 bills that all tie together, it's real difficult to see how they tie together if they're floating around separately. And secondly, just procedurally, there had to be 7 hearings and 7 notices, and et cetera. So we tried to get it into one consistent bill so people could see how it goes together. And unfortunately, that means it has to be a bill of some size. The second criticism the division was subjected to was that we always got our bills out late. We got them out either after the session had begun or right before the session, and there was never any time for any significant input by the industry or by the public that would be affected by these bills. And we listened to that also. And the first draft of this bill was out on October 1st. And then we sent out a notice to every licensee, every company, every group we could think of, both within and without the industry, saying, we need your help. And the response was really startling. People worked very, very hard on individual sections. For example, the adjusters worked on the adjusters part of the license, put in a massive amount of effort. And what we feel that we have is something that's very solid and very tight. We went on a lowest common denominator basis, not in that what's here is oatmeal, but what's here is what everyone could agree on was a good and positive change. There are some things that didn't make it into this bill that were in the first draft. Probably the biggest one is a change to the marine statutes. There's a change is definitely needed. We were proceeding along the road, and it was in here, and it just became too much for us to handle within the time that we had. So we'll go back and we'll revisit that. But the goal, the first goal is to get accredited. The second goal is to clean up the licensing statute. And the third goal is over time to work with those who have to live with this, with Title 21 every day, the insurance statutes every day, and come up with the changes necessary to have a set of insurance laws that make sense, where when it's referred to another statute, the other statute actually exists, and where with licensing and with other things that the industry has to do, we make it cost-effective and efficient for them and for us without compromising the public interest. What this bill does is summarized in a letter that should be in the front of your packets, individually addressed. And it contains about a page and a half of kind of bullet items. We went through these in front of House Labor and Commerce in great detail. They scheduled a series of work sessions that lasted three or four sessions and went through the bill literally section by section, line by line. We are certainly prepared and more than happy to do that. Now that that process has been done, I think I need to add, there were a couple of amendments. In fact, I have copies of the House amendments that were passed here and would submit them to the committee so you can see. And I'm actually, I was pleasantly surprised. What those amendments are, with the exception of a change that was made with regard to the trainee license, which I think is very, very positive, the rest of those are all noodles. They're just little things that were out there that the drafter missed or that our lawyers missed. And I was quite pleasantly surprised after the extensive hearing that it got on the other side that there were no problems at all. Our motto for this when we put it together was no hand grenades, because it is problematic to walk in the second session with a packet this big. We had a couple of very specific goals in mind and concentrated on those with the understanding that we may need to come and fight another day on things like the portion of the marine statutes. But what we wanted to present to you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and what I believe that we have, is a solid, tight piece of legislation that will accomplish the three goals of getting us accredited, redoing the licensing statute, and taking the first step towards redoing Title 21 so it makes sense in the 90s. I can go, Madam Chairman, into as much detail with the specifics of the bill as you or the committee would like. The folks from the division can go into minute detail because they are the technical experts. We are at your disposal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walsh. Are there any immediate questions for Mr. Walsh? Can you walk through with us, please, the certification process and who does it? What is it?
It is a relatively new program that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has entered into. It took them a couple of years to develop it in the latter part of the 80s.
I'm sorry, the National
Association of Insurance Commissioners.
Which is one from each state?
Well, yes, there are actually 55 insurance jurisdictions, the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Guam, and American Samoa. And they meet four times a year. And over the course of many years have developed model laws and model regulations. It's been a tremendous value, particularly to the smaller states, in the development of legislation and regulations. And there's always been an attempt, or a commitment anyway, to try to harmonize regulation between the states, et cetera. But in the late 80s, the people at the NAIC at the time, and I certainly can take no credit for it because I was not on board, saw that there was a real potential for an insurance crisis similar to that which has happened in other financial services. And in my view, they acted quickly and very well to get together a body of model laws that would prevent that. Probably the best example is Senate Bill 212, which you very fortunately for Alaska passed in the 1990 session. That sets up some criteria for companies and the kinds of investments they can get into. If that model law had been in place 3 or 4 years ago, executive life never could have happened, because it sets ceilings on the type of what percentage of the total any company can invest in any particular kind of investment. The other things are the guarantee associations, which again was passed in 1990, and it was very fortunate because we needed it starting in the beginning of 91 with executive life. But they set up this body of laws and regulations, which must be, as they put it, substantially in place. It's not that we are burning incense in front of their altar, because we are allowed to Alaskanize them. For example, we go farther in some areas than they go, into more detail, for example, in the surplus lines market because of our heavy reliance on the non-admitted market for aviation and marine insurance. And marine insurance is not a big item in Iowa. And so we can Alaskanize that portion. For example, in Iowa, they took the model crop insurance law and made that applicable in their state. And so the first portion of accreditation is the laws and regs, to make certain that there are the minimum tools there so that an insurance regulatory authority can actually regulate the market. And for that matter, that both the consumers and the industry can rely on those tools being in place.
If I could just break in,
sure.
Does this get us there, or do we have to have the parts 2 and 3, the marine and stuff?
This gets us there.
Okay.
This gets us there. The second part is the quantity and quality of staffing. We have in the budget a request for 13 positions. That will get us to 51 in the division, and I think that'll be enough. We normally, the smaller states, and we're not the smallest, I might add parenthetically, in terms of premium volume, but we have very few domestics. Normally, what they told me is they look for a number around 60, but because we have less than the average number of domestics, we don't need those domestic financial examiners. And I think 51 will do. They look, and it's not just a total number, a certain number have to be in financial examination, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third major portion on which we are working is the operational side. There have to be certain procedures to make sure, if you have the people and the tools, that you are actually using both to get the job done. We are most interested in early action on the bill, because they won't schedule a visit for us until the laws are in place, which seems to me to make sense. And they do it on a first-come, first-served basis. We are shooting for a late September visitation by the NAIC, and they come in, they review the laws and staffing and everything else, and then they go away, and then they issue a report, and then you either argue about it and agree or whatever, but we hope to be formally certified on the 10th of December at the NAIC winter meeting.
Any questions on that specific point?
Not on a specific point. I have other questions.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and ask your questions before he goes through the bullets?
Okay. Well, mine are kind of general questions more than specific questions. But you mentioned when you were making your statement that this would be beneficial to the consumer. Could you tell me how this would help the consumer?
With the accreditation of the department, the consumers will know that the state of insurance regulation in Alaska is up to national standards. They will hopefully be able to rely, and they will be able to rely, on our level of professionalism all across the board, so that if we do an examination or we get examination reports from other accredited states, they can rely on those. And there have been some problems in other states. Fortunately, knock wood, we have had only one insolvency, and that was Pacific Marine a few years ago. All of our domestics appear to be real solid. But a good regulatory authority is really an essential part of consumer protection. The second thing is that among the accredited states, there is not only reciprocity in terms of companies, but there's also in terms of information sharing. And we have a perfect example across the street in the courthouse right now. We have a major insurance fraud case that is ready for trial. It is beyond national scope, it is of international scope. And we were very fortunate in that the states of New Jersey and Maryland chose to cooperate with us, because that is the base from which this individual has been operating. But they did not have to. They did not have to honor our subpoenas, they did not have to honor our search warrants or issue their own. And we had, particularly with one of the states, more than a little difficulty initially getting cooperation. One of the part and parcel of accreditation is automatic reciprocity in those kind of enforcement things. We call and say, go get this guy, they have to go get him. And it's something that every state buys into. It is of tremendous benefit to states like ours, where geography is a problem in enforcement, and where a lot of the problems that arise in the smaller communities with really kind of esoteric types of insurance, like this individual was selling insurance to fishermen. And so I think that not only does the consumer benefit in general from more professional regulation, but they when they have a complaint or a problem, they will benefit specifically from what we are able to provide them and from what the reciprocity will get them from other states.
I have about two more questions. This is one of those kinds of bills that kind of gives you nightmares, because no matter how hard you try, it's hard to either stay awake or understand everything that's in it. And so I guess when I get to something like this, I like to know how it's going to impact the people who are dealing with it. How is this bill going to impact an adjuster?
Okay. Let me add one more thing that I forgot. Don just handed me a note, and I'm glad that he did. This also encourages both the retention and the development of the domestic insurance industry. If we have one problem in insurance in Alaska, it's that we don't have enough companies writing here. In auto, you have two or three companies that own the marketplace. I mean, they have the lion's share of the marketplace. In health insurance, it's even worse. You have three companies with 80% of the market. Companies are going to be much less likely to write in a non-accredited state, because they aren't going to have the reliance on the level of professionalism of the regulatory body. And that's important to them, because they have to contribute to the guarantee fund if there are problems. What this does for adjusters, for example, in specific, I believe, and I'm sure the staff will jump in if I misspeak, the only specific thing that an adjuster gets out of this, apart from all the general benefits of accreditation, is the licensing statute. It's going to be easier and simpler for an adjuster to get a license, keep a license, have the license renewed, etc. And we had adjusters, Reed Smith is the one that comes to mind, and there may have been one or two others who helped work on that specific portion of the licensing bill, and they're very happy with the product.
And how about brokers?
Brokers and other types of insurance professionals all benefit greatly, I believe, from this bill. From the accreditation side, I think it's going to help them bring in additional markets to the state, and that's going to help their business, as well as the people that they represent. And the licensing, I believe that the kind of garden variety broker and agent probably benefits more than almost any other type of licensee. They go to a single producer license. They have the multi-year option. With many of the brokerage firms, because of the size of those firms, the lump sum renewal or lump date renewal has been an administrative nightmare for them. And so they will also get the administrative benefit of that. In addition, on all levels of licensees, there's now going to be a trainee license, which is going to allow someone to come in, become an insurance professional in a manner which we believe protects the public interest, but also is of benefit not only to the individual, but to the firm that individual is being trained by. What we tried to do is, and it's not just the division, it's the profession as a whole, I believe, trying to raise the status of an insurance professional. We looked at what other professions do. whether it's medicine, law, accountancy, or whatever, there are some things that they do to bring people in, to train them, to make certain that they have a level of knowledge, etc., and to kind of bring them along without having to make them swallow everything at once. And so adjusters, brokers, everyone is going to be able to bring new people on board with a lot more ease under this bill than they have been in the past.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one final question. There are several bills before the legislature that would do some insurance reform with respect to health care. Is there going to be any conflict with any of those mechanisms, any of those bills and
no,
the reforms that are occurring in this bill?
No, ma'am. Not at all.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, other questions for Ms. Walsh? Okay. Why don't we take the time to go through the bullets and give us a feel for some of the actual provisions of the bill?
If you have the letter, it's dated January 28th.
It's the first one here.
In the book. That's the... the document from which I'll speak. Let me kind of, things arranged here. Okay. The, as I said, that initially the prime thrust is for the new model laws, or the model laws necessary for accreditation. And the first two items there, incorporating the model law and examination of insurance companies with regard to examination reports and the authority for the regulation when insurers found to be in hazardous financial condition. Both of those are from the NAIC models, and we consider them to be very important pieces, particularly the hazardous financial condition regulation. Hopefully that's something that will never have to be used in this state. And I said before, and I will reiterate, it does not appear that any of our domestics are in any jeopardy whatsoever. And we have, I think, a good professional working relationship with all of them. But one of the things that other states found is that when a company got into trouble, if their management was less than forthright, many times the regulatory authority had trouble going in without declaring an insolvency. In other words, they had to let it slip below the line where it was, where there was no other choice but to go in and liquidate, as opposed to going in early and working with them and saving the company. And the two best examples of each type of methodology are Executive Life, which is the bad example of a company staving off regulation in the state of California until it was just too late, and Mutual Benefit in New Jersey. They, Mutual Benefit, went to the regulators early and said, we're having a run on the bank, and we are not yet in the red, we are still in the black, but if you don't come in and help us, we're going to be in the red, and then it's going to be too late. New Jersey at that time did not have this regulation. They could not have gone in if Mutual Benefit's leadership had not been, in my view, forthright and thoroughly professional. This was added to the models necessary for precisely this reason. In the case of Mutual Benefit, and I don't know the individuals personally, but I think we can assume based upon their actions that they were honest and forthright people who were not trying to make a run on the bank. They found themselves in a hazardous situation and went for help. But this is a tool that that is, if it's ever needed, is going to be very important, because it will allow the division to go in the case of somebody who is less than forthright, who is trying to raid the company, suck out all the cash, and then leave a shell for liquidation. Now, this does not mean that the regulators can kind of go in like, you know, insurance stormtroopers willy-nilly. But what it does, because it sets up specific criteria. If the capital deteriorates, if the surplus deteriorates, if the various ratios, which are clearly understood by both the companies and the financial examiners alike, begin to deteriorate, then it allows us to do something. And so we consider that to be very important. The next one, changing the premium tax payments from April 1 to March 1, that again is more ministerial than anything else. The next five or so are all, again, going back to the various types of models that we need. Reinsurers requiring annual actuarial opinion from domestics, adopting the limitations on the types of subsidiaries, and that's one I think where we need to stop a while. Simply, and again, to to look at some of the insolvencies that we've had. It's sad but true that the insolvency, for example, with Executive Life, basically had nothing to do with their insurance operation. Their insurance operation was, is, and will remain very sound. What sunk Executive Life was two things. Number one, their heavy investment into junk bonds, and the legislature has already passed a model law which will take care of that problem. And secondly, getting into things that had nothing to do with insurance, and getting into to subsidiaries and other investments, basically using the insurance portion as the cash cow to fund it, but branching out into all sorts of things for which they did not have the expertise and which were incredibly high risk. And so that limitation, and this again is from a national model, I think will prevent that problem. The limitation on investment and premium in lower grade bonds, I mean, you can read Executive Life right there. This nails down the last possible loophole to that problem. There are all sorts of bond valuation offices that rate bonds. The NAIC has one that ranks them from 1 to 6, and this prohibits companies from having more than a certain percentage in those lower ranges. The lower ranges tend to be high risk, and there's nothing wrong with having a certain amount of money in what is potentially a high yield. Any investor does that, but it limits it to a prudential amount, so that if the high risk doesn't come through, the high yield doesn't come through, the solvency of the company is not compromised. The next two are also based upon problems that have occurred in other states. The material transaction between affiliates, this prohibits transferring money and assets back and forth to basically leave a shell with the insurance company and sticking the policyholders as a result. And then the Holding Company Act, which is the next one on that list, again is designed, and strangely enough, the good companies are very much in favor of this. It's designed to prevent a situation where you have a life insurance company that then forms a holding company and transfers all the assets up, and then they collapse the lower company. The banking regulators are also going to a similar thing nationally, because that's the way that some of the names that are now infamous in this country got all the money out of their financial institutions before the regulators got there. The next two I've dealt with, I think, at length, and that has those have to do with the licensing, the multi-year renewal, and the requirements and qualifications, et cetera, bringing that all into one chapter so it's easily readable for everyone. The next three are models: the reinsurance intermediary, brokers and managers, the licensing and operating of managing general agents, and the part of the model law that deals with people who call themselves financial planners in insurance when all they're selling is a non-insurance product. And again, I mean, it just seems like I'm beating up on Executive Life on the one hand, but on the other hand, who could deserve it more? A large part of what they did under the guise of selling insurance was doing nothing more than selling financial plans. The essence of insurance is the transfer of some risk other than the risk of money. The banks take the risk of money, and that's the difference between a bank and an insurance company. The risk that an insurance company takes has to be based upon something else other than cash, whether it's that the crops will fail or the creek will rise or whatever. And what they found, and again, knock wood, not in this state, but in others, is that people calling themselves insurance professionals and hawking insurance are basically doing nothing more than hawking financial products under what I think everyone who's looked at it feels are incorrect and unfair trade practices. The next five or so are also new, and the 30-day limit on unearned premiums to consumers who cancel insurance policies, that came directly from our consumer folks, because again, with a very few number of companies, unfortunately, it's really a case of a few bad apples. There have been interminable delays with return of premiums when people cancel, with unearned premiums when people cancel policies. The increase in violation, the maximum fines are increased substantially to $25,000. And the reason, and that's maximum, obviously not minimum, and it had taken an egregious situation for that to ever be invoked. But the problem is that with a $2,500 limitation, for a lot of these unscrupulous people, that's just a cost of doing business. This allows us to go in with a substantial fine and get the profit back. A good example, and probably one that is going to be classic in the annals of insurance scams, is something that was very big in the Southwest that we fortunately were able to nip in the bud last spring before any Alaskan was hurt. It was an organization called Our Father's Congregation, run by a guy named Melvin White out of Texas. And the deal with him was that this wasn't banking or insurance, this was religion. And if you joined his church for a one-time fee of about $1,000, you became eligible for a $100,000 no-interest loan that would be repaid at $100 a month. And to be eligible for this loan, you had to buy, in addition to your church membership, a one-time credit life policy on you so that it was all in place when you came up for your loan, with a fee for that anywhere between $750 and $1,500. And of course, there was no insurance company. There was, I guess it's arguable whether there was a religious institution, but no one was ever able to find any recipient of this $100,000 loan. Texas was on to these people, but we like to think we helped them get onto them a little faster. And there was a man in the valley who heard about this, signed up to sell it, and fortunately was a very honest fellow and called us to make sure it was okay. Well, it certainly wasn't. We contacted Texas. Texas hit Mr. White, and he apparently learned they were coming. He had 4 bank accounts. He cleaned out 2 of them, and I think it's reasonable to assume that he cleaned out the 2 with the most money in them before he fled. There was $16 million in the other 2. And this was all obtained from people of very moderate means. Now, this is obviously an extreme example, but to a person like Mr. White, a $2,500 fine is less than the cost of doing business. It's like not having change for a parking meter and figuring, well, I'll pay the $10. I've got an important meeting to go to. What this statute does is it says, a $25,000 fine isn't going to stop Mr. White, but it's going to stop a bunch of other people. And number two, it allows us to go after the profit. And we think this is a very, very strong consumer protection measure. And not to my surprise at all, the companies that have looked at this have, even the outside companies, have applauded it, because that's been the problem. And of course, when someone like Mr. White comes in and does this, it's the good companies that pay for it in terms of their reputation in the marketplace. The next one is also, we feel, very, very important. And that's to allow an insurable interest among charitable organizations. There's a Senate bill, can you remember the number? We'll get to the number. But Senator Frank.
House bill came over.
And the House bill, which has already passed, that allows 501c3s to have a charitable interest. This goes a little farther, and we believe the bills are most compatible. There's no problem at all with passing them both, just as is. We attempted to set out the other types of charitable organizations other than 501c3s. There's 170, et cetera, et cetera. And to be honest, as I said across the way yesterday, the only thing I know about tax is if you get 4 of them, you can hold a map to the wall. And so we had tax lawyers look at this, and this is what they said to do. And we feel real comfortable that what we have here is going to allow charitable institutions to do this kind of planned giving without opening, the door to charlatans. The next one, financial requirements for title insurers similar to other insurers, and that's, again, to level the playing field. We've got no objection to that. Licensing of attorneys in fact, that's more technical in nature than anything else. The next one is also important, and it's the kind of thing that it would have been a nice tool to have when the PACMAR problem arose and other states have found it a very important tool. And that is, if an insurance company is liquidated, the receiver has the right to go back and recover distributions within the last 12 months. A lot of times what happened, as for example what happened in Executive Life, is that there were some significant bonuses declared right before the company was taken over. And this makes it absolutely clear that that the receiver has the ability to go in and get those dollars back. The next three are... The next two are basically ministerial in nature, again, part of our Clean Out the Closet program. Cleans up the Fraternal and Benefits Society's requirements and limitations, and clarifies the senior premium discount that it has to be offered. There's an ambiguity in an existing statute. Finally, there's an appraisal clause for settling claim disputes that we think is also a good measure for both the consumer and the company alike, to make certain that we avoid litigation if it's possible on the valuation of a claim. We anticipate, Madam Chair, that there will be other items that might arise. We look forward to them. We will work to solve whatever problems are necessary. As I said before, we tried to put together a bill with no hand grenades, and if any member of the public or the legislature has any questions, we will do whatever we can to make certain that they're answered and that any problems are solved. I just, and by way of closing, would point out the level of commitment among the staff at the division. There were 50 copies of this ring binder put together, and this is roughly 500 pages per copy. That's 25,000 sheets of paper. We did not get the bill from the drafter until Friday night at 5, and by Monday morning, these were done. And there was no overtime submitted, and it was Super Bowl Sunday that it happened. So there's a very motivated and dedicated group of people at the division, and also in the task force that believe in this bill, and we highly recommend it.
Any pizza and beer stains?
No pizza, and at least not on this. I have a sweatshirt that'll never be the same. But.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Other questions? Senator Halpert.
What would you do if you had the bill and no money?
You mean if the budget positions weren't that? It'd still be good to have the bill. Because those tools would be in place if we ever needed them. And that portion of the accreditation would be in place should the legislature and governor ever decide to fund those positions. This is buying all sorts of spare tires. That's all I can say. I mean, there is nothing here that is superfluous. And in terms of the positions, all those positions are fee-related. There's not for example, the student loan folks say that they are program receipt-driven because they hire people to call deadbeats and deadbeats pay, and that's their program receipt. We are different. We charge for the call. The $2.5 million in rough terms that is in the FY92 budget for the operation of the division is all generated with fees, exams, etc. It's not a dime of premium tax, not a dime of general fund money, other than the fact that it goes through the general fund for appropriation. If our budget were cut $500,000, it would have no effect on the revenue or on the budget of the state at all, because those are just fees we wouldn't charge. And not to get into the budget, but one of the reasons for those new positions, and one of the things that we are all very committed to, is leveling the playing field for the businesses in Alaska. One of my predecessors estimated that there was $20 million worth of unpaid premium tax, primarily by outside brokers, because they know that we do not have the live humans to go and do the audits and collect the money. I think that's probably high, but to test that theory, we sent a team, we basically shut down everything else we had to do, sent a team to Seattle to do those examinations. At the end of the day, there were over $200,000 in fines, and the difference in tax revenue for this year is probably going to be about $500,000. And what we want to do with those positions is to make certain that all the tax gets paid. There's a significant amount of revenue that by law the state ought to be getting now that we believe it's not. But more importantly, if you look at the domestic market share, particularly in the high ticket items, the big property and casualty bids that go out, etc., the Alaska market share is going down, and it's going down significantly. And my predecessor was convinced, and to be honest, Senator, I'm coming to the same conclusion, that one of the reasons that that's happening is that outside brokers can beat Alaskan bids by as much as 3.7%, depending upon the line of insurance, because they're not building the premium tax into it. They may build two, and on a big risk, like an office building or a fleet of cars or a fleet of heavy machinery, that 3.7% is a lot of money. Or they're beating it by 2.7% and pocketing the extra 1%. That, when we found some instances of that. And that's what those positions are for. It is not a fair situation to the insurance professionals in this state who, by and large, comply with the law because we've always had the coverage to get them, and because there's a lot of monitoring that goes on within the marketplace here just by itself. It's unfair to them for them to lose market share because they're complying with the law simply because the regulatory authority that's supposed to protect them as well as the consumer doesn't have the guns to go out and do its job. So that has nothing to do with this bill, and I apologize for the
it's just going to be very difficult in this kind of a budget cycle to sell new positions, whether they're program receipt driven or general fund driven, because they're still driven by state funds. It's you know,
right,
how you get it and where it comes from. Program receipts by constitution are general fund dollars.
Right, but in our instance, for our operating funds, if you cut the money, you don't get it. It's just something that doesn't get done. Because we can't go.
Anybody
do it.
Who is auditing and collecting would make that same argument in any department.
No,
whether it was oil and gas audit or anybody else.
Senator, I don't wish to debate with you, but we are set up by statute differently. Because if I send these folks out and they collect $1,000 and the cost of their exam is $100, the state gets the $1,000 and we bill the person that they examined for the $100. And I think I believe that that's unique in the government. If an auditor for, again, student loan is a good example, goes out and collects $1,000 that's past due, that's all there is. And if he or she does not go out and do that, the state loses the $1,000. But by cutting that position, there's another $100 available to go somewhere else. In our position, in the Division of Insurance, if the $100 is cut, it's gone because it's not billed.
Sounds like you're already doing what DEC wants to do and what everybody's complaining about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we one of the nice things about running this division is that it's probably more like running a private business than any other, because we know exactly what our revenues are going to be. I can't come to you and say, I would like X number of more dollars so that I can go do this or I can go buy that. By law, we have to live within the fees that we generate. And if that box of fees goes down, that money just goes away because we can't charge it. So I think
we
that
can't charge
they
fees
run like a law firm.
For
if
services,
you call them,
we
you
don't
get a bill.
Yeah.
You gotta do that with DEC.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
It really
DEC wants to do.
Well,
that's why every restaurant in the state's having a fit right now.
Well, it also is very, very good, we feel, on a number of fronts, because the cleaner an organization is when we go in, the less time they're going to spend there. And the less time they spend there, the less it costs them. And so there's a real incentive for them to comply with the statutes and the record keeping, et cetera.
Okay, all of your new positions are in that status? Everything in your budget's in that status?
No, there's like the new consumer complaint person. We don't bill for consumer complaints because some of them are, you know.
Okay, how's that position funded?
It's all funded by essentially the charges that
you charge everybody else a little bit more,
right,
for that guy too.
Right. The other positions that are in there that are not direct bill out are some clerical positions that are really really needed. These folks can tell you they're. Ranges 19 through 21, and they're typing their own letters and they're doing their own filings. And the problem with that is what these people ought to be doing. What their job ought to be is to be out there on the street.
But that cost is also rolled into the direct bill outs.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, right now you have basically a couple of positions in the aggregate going for range 19 file clerks, and that's crazy.
Other questions? Mr. Walsh, thank you very much. We'll look
thank
forward
you.
To seeing you again on the 26th. I know you look forward to it. Mr. Frank, please.
Madam Chair, I signed up because I wasn't sure what the intention of the committee is. For the most part, we support this bill. We've got a few things we're working on. I'd be inclined just to reserve any comments we have.
Okay, that's fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone else in the audience want to testify today on Senate Bill 376? Okay, if not, we will close the testimony today on 376 and go on to the next bill. As I said before, and as much as is possible, we would like to have comments, concerns, proposed amendments to us by the 21st, which is a week from Friday. We will be bringing the bill back up on the 26th for both public testimony and also to go through any changes that have been worked through by the
Madam Chairman, if anyone has any questions or wants to go through specific pieces of this bill, just have them give us a call.
Mr. Walsh, I can assure you that we will refer them to you. Absolutely no chance it will be otherwise. Thank you all for your time.
He actually has done a very good job and with everybody. I mean, he spent quite a bit of time twice. The division spent a lot of time working with the networking with them to make sure that things are pretty
some of his amendments do that too.
All right.
Because I went and told him earlier that I was not a supporter until we dealt with the ability of the secretary to answer the phone and tell somebody something about their account.
Okay, next we have a first hearing on House Bill 247, which relates to the licensure of dentists through credentialing, although it doesn't say that. We have the prime sponsor, Representative Jerry Mackey. Mr. Mackey, the floor is yours. Everybody has a complete packet with all of the information that you have provided to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate senators taking the time to hear this bill today. I think this, I'll try to be brief. The bill is pretty much a house cleaning bill, and I provided you with a sponsor statement and an amendment that I would like to ask you to consider. This bill was introduced to clarify the licensure of dentists by credentials provisions relating to the Board of Dental Examiners. Alaska law has allowed dentists to be licensed by credentials since 1980. The Board of Dental Examiners has refused to license by credentials and passed a regulation that they would not license by credentials, claiming that the statute was too vague. In January of 1991, the Board of Dental Examiners lost a legal proceeding in Superior Court in which 23 dentists sued for the right to be licensed by credentials as allowed under Alaska law. The board was ordered to begin licensing by credentials under existing statute. CS for House Bill 247 presents a series of requirements for licensure by credentials, sets out standards applicants must meet, and requires the board to license by credentials in accordance with the court decision. The bill adds other provisions to the dental statute, such as requiring dentists to be current in CPR techniques. Other provisions that dentists may not be licensed if in another state they have had their license revoked, suspended, or surrendered. They are the subject of an unresolved complaint. They are involved in fraudulent or criminal activity, or they are impaired. Many dentists affected by this bill are military or public health service employees who came to Alaska through their employment and seek to set up private practice. Alaska does not have an overabundance of health care practitioners. We need to encourage health professionals to live and practice in our state. In the last 9 months, the Board of Dental Examiners has complied with the court ruling and licensed 46 applicants for licensure by credentials. Another 20 applicants have been interviewed by the board recently and are eligible for licensure. The credentialing application process is controlled by the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. The division has set time standards to complete the application process and forwards all complete files to the board for review at each quarterly meeting. I've submitted a proposed amendment to the committee for your consideration. This language would assure that dentists employed by federal agencies may be considered for credentialing. Subsection A1D of AS 836-234 on page 4, lines 12 through 14 was amended in the House Rules Committee to require a dentist who applies for credentialing to have been engaged in 5 years of active clinical practice prior to application if they're licensed in the jurisdiction in which they practice. Federal employees are frequently relocated and therefore may not have been in the same jurisdiction the 5 years prior to application. They also are exempt from licensure in the state while employed by the federal government. This amendment clarifies the subsection so that it cannot be narrowly interpreted to exclude those individuals. House Bill 247 is a good bill with public's best interest, and I urge your consideration.
Thank you very much, Representative Mierke. Do we have questions for the representative? Senator Halpert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's several things I have specific questions on, and I'll just go through them. Page 5, lines 16 through 19. 16 through 19 deal with the credentialing section, and it provides, in addition to the grounds for revocation of a license under AS 0836315, the board may revoke a license issued without a clinical examination upon evidence of misinformation or substantial omission. Is there some reason in your mind that we should treat applicants by credentialing differently than we should treat applicants by examination, or is that a provision that should be applied equally to both credential applicants and examination applicants? Why would we want to say that if you get your license by credentials, if there's anything wrong, you lose your license, but if you get your license by examination, which you also have to prove that a lot of the same things, including the dental school and so forth, that you shouldn't have the same situation?
Yeah, I Senator, I understand what you're getting at, but this bill is dealing with licensing by credentials. Is there another section that allows for examination? I guess I don't understand the question.
There are two ways that you get your dentist license. One is by examination, one is by credentials. If we're going to say that someone is going to lose his license based on misinformation or omission, shouldn't we be saying that equally to those licensed by credentials or by examination?
I think what this was designed for was in the event they gave misinformation as far as their credentials and that kind of stuff, that the board can then go and revoke their license.
But this is an additional condition that only applies to those who apply by credentials, not those who apply by examination.
Well, I think everybody would have to be licensed by credentials if this bill passed.
No. You still have two systems. You have a system of examination. Somebody graduates from dental school, and they're licensed by examination by the Western Regional Exam, and so forth and so on. That's one system. The other system is somebody that's already practicing, is a federal dentist, is another state dentist, and so forth. And what you're doing is putting in statute.
Okay.
The reason I'm asking technical questions and specific questions is I've been involved in this battle for years.
Sure.
And essentially, the associations opposed exactly these things, finally lost the court case. And now we're coming back, and I don't want to see us building unnecessary obstacles in which still discriminate against credential dentists versus examination dentists. And I think there would be influence to do that any way that they could.
Okay. I was confused. I understand the question now. I would agree with you that it should be, you know, the same, but perhaps...
Senator Halpert, I think it's probably handled under the Unlawful Act section of the statutes 0836, 315 through 340, which are grounds for discipline, suspension, or revocation, which have a blanket if you engaged in deceit, fraud, or intentional misrepresentation in the course of providing... stuff, but we will check that and make sure that we do have an equal playing field. I agree with you, and I think perhaps we just need to...
If it is covered, I'd like to omit that sentence. That's the question.
Okay.
If it's not covered, then it should be covered for both sides. That's my point.
Yeah, we will figure that out and make sure that the language says what we're trying...
Okay, I understand that. I think Ms. Boudreaux from Occupational Licensing might be able to answer that question.
Yes, I did not think to bring a copy of the regular dental statute to see what it says in there. I do know that with a lot of the existing ones, it does have that, whether it's by exam or credentials. And then it's kind of forecasting, but we have introduced a centralized licensing statute cleanup, which definitely does say that across the board for all boards, so that we... have equality, that one profession isn't harder or easier than another one.
I think
we'll check it with the attorneys, but in our packets that we have, we do have the statutes. And on page 15, I'm going to Senator Halpert at the
16,
bottom. Well, it's the bottom page 15, actually. If you used or knowingly cooperated in deceit, fraud, or intentional misrepresentation to obtain a license.
Right. That should cover it.
I think that covers it. We maybe don't need...
Do you think maybe we don't need that language in here? I think our intent with Senator Halford was to just to make it as clear as possible that, you know, in this credentialing aspect, which is where the court case was lost. And if you feel comfortable that it doesn't need the language, I have no problems with taking it out. However, I think it probably just strengthens this particular statute by having it in there, but maybe it's not necessary.
We'll work with the attorneys. I see your point. We don't want to have another. And I know that Department of Commerce has two amendments that they would like us to look at that are in their position paper, and Representative Mackey just brought this position paper with his proposed amendment to us, so we will be holding it over. We'll work together to figure out a CS that has the elements and bring it back hopefully next week. Okay. Senator Halford, I know you've got more questions.
There are several other questions in there, and they're covered. They're on page 4 and 5, and there are several other provisions that, again, only apply to credentialing. And you know, their intent seems to be reasonable, but I'm worried about their effect. For example, is not the subject of an unresolved complaint, investigation, review procedure, or disciplinary proceeding undertaken by a dental licensing jurisdiction or a law enforcement agency. I want to make sure that that doesn't mean that somewhere in somebody's file in Oklahoma, they don't have a complaint filed by somebody 10 years ago that didn't want to pay the bill and therefore complained. I mean, what does really an unresolved complaint mean? And is that also very broad in terms of giving a board that hasn't been very willing to issue licenses another reason not to issue a license? That's one place we deal with it. Another place is not the subject of an adverse report in the National Practitioner Data Bank. I don't know enough about that to know that. I mean, is that a report of a complaint, or is that a report of an actual action? And the last one is not the subject of an adverse peer review report from a state, territory, or local dental society or any other territory. Are these dental societies, you know, what are they? Are they state regulatory agencies, or are they organizations of professionals who may or may not agree with even the existing statutes in their own state? Those things are a series of questions I think I'd like to look at. And there's one last one, and that is on page 4, line 21G. It says, may not have failed the Western Regional Examination. The way I read that, they may not have failed it ever, even if, in fact, they went back later, they failed it the first time, and they passed it a second time. So they failed it 10 years ago, they passed it 5 years ago. But the way this has not failed the clinical examination of this state, and within the preceding 3 years has not failed the clinical examination given by the Western Regional Examining Board. Well, you know, if they failed it in this state ever, or the Western region within the last 3 years, in the 10 years when we said credentialing was supposed to occur and it didn't, the people that wanted to be credentials applied for the state exam, and some of them failed that exam. With the existence of this law, they were allowed in under the court case. And yet, if we pass this new version, we may be saying the very same people are then excluded again. Not again, Sammy.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've listed off a number of them there.
Those are my concerns, having dealt with this issue for years and years. That's what.
And Senator Halford, the chair has indicated they'd hold it over. I'd be happy to look into those concerns for you and get back to you. I think, you know, the intent here was to cover all of those types of things, and maybe the language isn't quite right. Not being an attorney or something, I needed to rely on our drafters to be able to make the determination that the language is proper to cover what we needed to cover. And the part about having not failed a clinical examination is pretty standard, because, I mean, if they did pass it, then obviously they would be eligible to be licensed. So, I mean, but if they haven't.
But what we're saying is if they meet all the other conditions for licensure under credentials, but because the state of Alaska refused to license for credentials in the 10-year period that this was fighting its way finally to the court system, they took the test and failed it. They may still be a federal dentist, But that statute may prohibit them from ever getting licensed by credentials. Although if they had never taken the test, they would be eligible for licensure by credentials. And that's the class that are in a major internal battle in the dental community over this whole thing.
Right. Senator Halpert, we've been, first of all, you know, this is not like a big burning issue in my district. I think I might only have two dentists in my whole district, but, you know,
I think the ones that were talking to me have died of old age.
I realize that those of you with significant longevity around here have dealt with this issue a lot, so it's a kind of learning experience to me also. However, we have made every effort to deal with the people that were involved in the lawsuit, as well as the dental society, as well as the public health dentist, as well as occupational licensee. The DA's office, I mean the AG's office, and also the attorneys for the litigants and everything. So everybody appears to be happy with this, but obviously you have some more concerns that we'll try to run back through the hopper and see where we.
You may have covered them all. I'm just have a suspicious nature.
Sure.
But it's good of you to have a statewide perspective.
Right. Well, actually, my interest is. In seeing more dentists be able to be licensed, I think it's good for everybody in the state, and not have a good old boys club that decides if they don't like how you look that you don't get licensed. And I don't necessarily, I'm not saying that's exactly what's happened, but there has been that assumption made by maybe the court and a few other people. So we're just trying to correct it, and the dental society's worked very well with us as well as the other side of the issue. And so hopefully we'll be able to bring back to you by the next hearing answers to your questions.
Yeah, if you've got the answers to them, I support what you're trying to do.
Sure.
I think we ought to do it. It needs to get done. It was an argument in the very first sunset review of the dental board, and it's been an argument ever since.
Okay. Okay, other questions for Representative Mackey? Mr. Mackey, would you like to join us at the table? You're welcome to, and I know Ann Boudreau wants to testify.
Okay, I wasn't aware Commerce had some amendments.
Let's let her give us her position paper. It does have.
They may have already been covered in earlier.
Yeah, I believe so. I
think their amendments are already in there, Drew. Their amendments are
in there.
Yeah, I believe the position paper that you have was from last year, and I would say that Representative Mackey's office was responsive to several of the concerns that we had, and some of the sections that we had concerns about have actually been taken out. And the part about the exam, whether or not they have to take the REB regional exam, which created a conflict for us, is out. And they've clarified section 08-36-234-2 has been clarified to say only the jurisprudence exam, in other words, the part about Alaskan laws. And we think that's entirely appropriate that somebody be tested on that and not for the other, and so we're in agreement with that. Through the chair, to Representative Mackey, you referenced an amendment, and I don't believe that I had a copy of that.
Nobody's asked.
That probably addresses the other comment that we still had.
This whole process has been real interesting. We've had last-minute amendments throughout the whole process, and I mean, we even had a whole section in here dealing with dental hygienists, and one thing I learned is you don't want to get the dental hygienist mad at you, so we took all of that.
Well, that was one of the concerns I missed.
especially when you have an agreement between the hygienist and the dentist, and then they decide that maybe they want a little bit more out of the agreement, so we decided I'm not going to deal with it.
Well, my policy has always been, if you're sitting in a chair and you're leaning back and somebody's got a very sharp instrument, yes, you don't want to mess with it.
That's when they lobby the best.
Yeah, and come to find out that my next-door neighbor is the president of the dental hygienist, and so I heard from her rather regularly.
The only other comment that we had, which I believe the amendment, if I was catching everything, might cover, was that the section 08-36... 234D tied in both the fact that they had to have practiced, had a license in another jurisdiction for the 5-year period, but had tied in that the practice in the jurisdiction also had to have been within the same jurisdiction for which they were licensed. And so I think the amendment covered that concern.
Right.
I would comment that it's not superfluous to add that word licensed under the practice. We just had a challenge to someone who was denied by the board. They appeared to be pretty competent. They had been out of school. They had been licensed for only 4 years. They were wanting to claim the fact that they had been teaching as active practice. And it became a real debate. We had asked for some letters and so forth. And because we were saying that without being licensed, was there anybody to really watch over their actions and to report anything that might have been a violation and so forth? There's also the argument, is teaching really practicing? And it appeared that in their teaching, they held some public clinics and there were members of the public that came in. But it was very, very hard to tell. Were they actually working on these public members? Were they just supervising student dentists who were? What was it? And we would much prefer to have it clear that it's 5 years of license, because we could see that the next step would be somebody that was claiming graduate school or something as, well, I've already graduated and I passed some exams and so I've been doing something else. And so we really appreciate that addition. And through the chair to Senator Halford, the question on the National Practitioner Data Bank, those are only completed actions, and for the most part, they're either an involvement with drugs, either where they have been improperly taking them and becoming impaired themselves, or dispensing them too freely. It could also include something like Medicare fraud, you know, where they've been doing fraudulent billing and so forth, but it's actual convictions or licensing actions.
Okay, that takes I. How about J?
Was that the unresolved complaint?
Is not subject to an adverse peer review report from a state, territory, or local dental society in any other state or territory.
Okay, that, in my opinion, would not be a regulatory agency. That would be something like a trade association, like, you know, the Oklahoma State Dental Society or something. And it could be, I could envision where that might be a difference of whether a certain practice was considered traditional or not, like maybe some dentists
amalgam versus
removing the fillings, or whether he's giving vitamin C transfusions when they do it or something. Somebody might say that's not good practice, we don't like that, and it's not been proven to be efficacious or something, and might write them up for that, whereas a licensing agency might say that's not a problem. But I'd probably have to take a closer look to see, but that's what that sounds like to me. And unresolved complaint, yeah, that could just be something that's never been closed out.
Representative Mackey.
Yeah, we, Senator Halford, as I pointed out earlier, we've been real careful to run the language and these things by also the people that won the court case, that group of dentists, and make sure that, you know, the language wasn't still conflicting, as well as the attorney, Ev Gross, that represented them. And, you know, that I was going to suggest that was one thing the Dental Society suggested be in there, and I was going to ask if perhaps Sam could respond to that particular point.
Senator Halford.
Yeah, just so you, I mean, what happens in most of these regulatory cases, the people on the outside are arguing with the people on the inside. As soon as the people on the outside get inside, they immediately start to defend against the people who are now on the outside. And the people who won the court case have all been licensed under credentialing. Now they have an economic interest on the opposite side of the issue that they were on a year ago. And going back to their attorneys and making sure that they think it's okay to limit anybody else who might have taken and failed the state exam still isn't necessarily getting all the people that may be out there in federal service who happen to be stationed at ADAC now and not paying attention, but 2 years from now might be interested. So it still isn't, I mean, you know, the people that sued finally won the case, but they are also in the 46 new credential dentists, and they're already inside of the system.
Okay. Senator Halford, I think certainly subsection J bears review, so we figure out who, if any, local dental society, which could consist of three people, if two of them got mad at a third, and there was an adverse peer review, or even a letter to the file, the way this
That's
reads, they could use that to hang their hook of not giving a license. I also don't know whether we have that same language under examination licensing, whether they're also supposed to look to see whether or not there's been any adverse peer review. If we've got the same things out there, perhaps we ought to change both of them, but we need to look to see what sort of information.
Yeah, the two that remain are J, which is that one,
mm-hmm.
and
G.
No, E, I think it is. Not subject of an unresolved complaint.
Right, and G needs to be fixed.
Right.
J and G. Those are the two areas that you have still have concerns.
J, E, and G.
J, E, and G. Yeah. Did you have responses to any of those other two?
Let's get Sam to
this.
And then you want to fix on page 5 that other.
Right.
Okay. Section J.
Ms. Keough, do you have responses to any of this, the three subsections that...
Well, on J.
Yes,
sir. The peer review statute in the state of Alaska is similar to other statutes in other states where the peer review is given to the Dental Society by the Dental Practices Act that you passed about 3 or 4 years ago that authorizes a society to have a peer review system so that if there are any complaints against the dentist, they take care of it themselves. And it doesn't go to only the conclusion of that peer review comes to the licensing agency, occupational licensing. So they do their own. If they have an action of a patient that has made a complaint against the dentist, the peer review system, authorized by state statute, they do the peer review.
That's just like the doctors?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if there's a recommendation as a consequence of that peer review, they send it to the licensing agency. That's what they're saying in that, is that if the peer review system that you are using to review other dentists professionally, then the result of that peer review should be taken into consideration when you give a license by credential.
Is there a name for that committee? If we put the name of the committee in, that would maybe tighten it up.
Well, it's I'd have to go back to the statute. I don't have the statute here, but we just went through the Dental Practices Act that authorized it 2 or 3 years ago. And on the peer review segment, in the peer review segment.
See the exact name of it.
Yeah, let's go back and find that.
And then that clarifies it.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it's limited to a formal peer review process that is statutory either in this state or in another state, then it's not the potential for abuse. Yeah. And that's what we got to find out on all of these.
So it doesn't necessarily have to list that organization. We just need to make sure that it's as specific in the statute.
It's got to be something that compares. I mean, the language that they use over on the other side about must have a licensing requirement at least equivalent in scope, quality, and difficulty of those. Well, you turn around and say, a peer review report similar to Alaska's in scope under, authority and so forth. Under AS and list the statute.
Okay. Very good. We'll do that, Senator.
And we need the same kind of clarifiers on subject of an unresolved complaint. Right? Unresolved complaint to who? Investigation, review procedure, disciplinary proceeding undertaken by a dental licensing jurisdiction or law enforcement agency. I just don't want this to be, there is a letter of complaint in this. Oh, no, we can't get a hold of the guy, but the letter's still in the file.
You might even want to define unresolved complaint.
I think, Madam Chair,
for the purposes of the statute.
Senator Alford, I think that what I'll do is have our legal people actually address in a memo form to this committee why the language is there, because I would agree with you that we shouldn't have language that's so vague that it could be any complaint. But however, there may be again another statute that defines this,
yep,
and maybe we need
fine.
To list subject to AS or whatever and actually list it there. On section G was the other one was you said you had concerns of has not failed the clinical examination
of this state within the previous. Well, you see the way it reads, and it's where you put the comma, has not failed the clinical examination of this state and comma. What that means has never failed the clinical examination of the state of Alaska, and then it says and within the previous 3 years has not failed the clinical examination given by the Western Regional Examining Board. It's the first phrase of that, and where the comma is that says that the 3 years doesn't apply to both of them, that it applies to the Western Regional Exam. And I think it's a mistake to say that no one can ever be licensed by credentials who has ever failed the clinical examination of this state.
Okay. Senator Halford, do you have someone on your staff who could work with
no.
Committee staff? Yes, you do. Committee staff, and also with Representative Mackey and his staff, because I think we can make this go more quickly, frankly, if we don't do memos back and forth to each other. It would be much easier to have people sit down with the drafter and go through it and say, here's our concern, and they say, okay, and off we go to circumvent. Just because.
Yeah, my staff, as Nancy's worked on this, and I will have her get with legal right away and then bring it to Senator Alford's staff.
I think she probably understands it without.
She probably could answer all your questions for you, actually.
Madam Chair, on the issue of the board, it is identified in the statute as the Board of Dental Examiners. And it then refers to the board throughout, so maybe instead of the.
Peer review.
It's not subject of an officer's peer. I would say Board of Dental Examiners Review, which is what your peer review, I think, is addressing, right? You're talking about the Board of Dental Examiners.
I think Sam's saying that the Dental Society is doing it outside of the board.
Well, the Dental Society does it outside of the board, okay. But the results that they do go back to the dental board and to under the licensing mm-hmm. jurisdiction for all peer review actions that are taken.
Okay. We'll figure out.
Okay.
What
that works. Yeah, that does need to be clarified.
I think we've identified. Senator Happy, have you identified all of your questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Senator Kraft, Senator Collins, Dreiderman, do you have additional questions? Okay. On a formal basis for the committee, let's put this bill into subcommittee. Senator Happy and myself will act as chair, and we will try to have something to see us with everybody's concerns modified and back to the committee. Representative Mackey, because the Senate's going on a long weekend, I don't know if we'll have it back next Wednesday or we'll attempt to have it back by the following Monday at the very latest. But I'm just not sure we'll get there.
All right.
Additional comments from you?
No, to be honest with you, there's just one section that I thought about when I was sitting here, and one of the requirements, one of the new requirements that we have in here, I guess I should know the answer, but we're requiring them to be certified in CPR and that kind of stuff. That's all good. There's one section in there that said that they can't be licensed if they're impaired. I guess I am assuming that there's a statute that deals with what exactly
yes.
impaired is. One of our colleagues is a dentist, and that was the first thing obviously
not that kind of
not
impaired.
Right.
It's,
I mean,
right.
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's defined in your bill.
I mean, there was some concern over that, and I didn't want this to get to the floor and have a problem with that.
Different impairment.
Mr. Joe, do you have any other comments?
The only other one was on this issue of unresolved. Or actually, or on any of them, I do have somebody that's a supervisor that had worked for the dental board and is now supervising the person that does that, and I would make them available to your subcommittee if you wanted to.
Who is that?
Kevin Messing.
Okay.
And
excellent.
He knows all about all the exams and whatnot, because Senator Halford has a good concern about being unresolved, but I believe one reason for having something like that is to avoid the person that says, oh, I'm about to get in
yeah.
trouble
oh,
here.
Yeah.
Let's go escape yeah. to Alaska
sure.
and
yeah.
get a lot of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's absolutely legitimate.
Mr. Keto, do you have any additional comments for the record?
Just that the Dental Society supports the legislation.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Okay, with that, we will adjourn the committee and we will try to have it back next Wednesday.
Great, appreciate it.
Now, and we aren't going to take up these.
Oh, no,
let's
no,
not
take them.
No, everything else is still over.
Long time.